I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Public defenders are the attorneys who, at the government's expense, take on cases for people who otherwise couldn't afford representation. Missouri's public defender's office is one of the least funded per capita in the country. Today, we consider the mental health toll this all takes on the public defenders themselves. We'll also ask if overworked attorneys in a severely tight budget impinge on a client's right to a fair trial. Then, companies around the country are struggling to fill tech jobs. It's a need that one nonprofit rooted in Missouri is trying to help satisfy. We'll learn about a couple of lives they've changed. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The head of the Kansas City Public Defender's Office has said her office's attorneys are so overworked that they're unable to fulfill their ethical obligations to their clients. The problem is so severe that some public defenders say they need immediate mental health leave, while others consider even hurting themselves. The attorneys have been described as ticking time bombs. For good reason, the state of Missouri ranks 49th in public defender spending per capita. To meet the American Bar Association's requirements for the amount of time that Missouri public defenders should invest in case preparation, they would have to work more than 24 hours a day every day of the year. How much pressure is there? We're about to find out. Here to talk about the ticking time bomb that is the public defender system in Missouri are Michael Barrett. He's the state of Missouri's public defender director. He joins us on the phone this morning from Branson. Michael, good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Ruth Petch heads the Kansas City Public Defender's Office. That's the largest public defender's office in the entire state of Missouri. Ruth, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Dr. Greg Nawalnick is a psychologist and clinic director of the University of Kansas Health System's Strawberry Hill campus. Dr. Nawalnick, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning.
Ruth, when you've testified in court about the workload challenges facing your clients, you've become overwhelmed with emotion. Just how bad is it?
It's pretty bad. It's hard to talk about because I really care about the people in my office and I care about their well-being. And I know what great, talented people they are and how they can't do what they want to for clients and how demoralizing that is for them.
You know, Michael Barrett, you head the system for the state. You've been clamoring for more funding for years. Has anything gotten better?
You know, we've received incremental increases over the last couple of years, and I credit the legislature for that. But the problem is that the caseloads are exceeding the increases in resources, and so we can't keep up. If we get enough funding to handle, say, an additional 100 or 200 or even 1,000 cases per year, but an extra 4,000 or 5,000 are coming in the door, that's still a problem.
Is it fair to say, Michael, that in the state of Missouri, there are tens of thousands of individuals who have been charged with crimes who are effectively here being denied their constitutional right to representation? Is it that problematic?
It is, because timely representation is effective representation. They need an attorney who is competent from the very first critical stage, which is the initial appearance, whether a decision is made on whether they're going to go home that day or whether they're going to be incarcerated pretrial. So, yes, that's absolutely the case. And it's just the cases are coming in the door so fast
right.
that our resources can't keep up with them.
Ruth, I want to make sure I get this right. The caseloads are so enormous that public defenders in Missouri would have to work, I can't believe this, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, to give each of their clients the minimum level of representation they deserve. Do I have that right?
I would say that that's underestimating, but yes.
Because you can't do more time than 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right. You can't do the job. That's correct.
Yeah. Dr. Greg Nowalnick, you're a psychologist. You're hearing this talk of ticking time bombs and lawyers saying they're in fear of their own mental health because of these extreme workloads. What's going through your mind as you hear all this?
I mean, it's completely valid. What I'm hearing here is a Sisyphus-like existence of just rolling a boulder up every day, knowing that the next morning it's going to roll back down. You have to start over at square one. This is the perfect recipe for burnout, and burnout, if unchecked and untreated, will eventually lead to a suicidal potential.
You know, what do you advise when these lawyers work for a system that continues to crank out clients and isn't easing the pressure on them? What can they do? I mean, it seems intractable to me.
I would agree 100%. The only thing that they can do, which is something that doesn't sound like a luxury they have available to them, is set firm boundaries where, you know, at the end of the workday, put work away, put the email away, don't respond to calls that have to do with work, really engage in effective self-care, exercise, spending social time with friends. But these are all things that burnout works against. They actually will start to isolate. There will be physical symptoms that, like stomach upset, the anxiety that will impact their sleep. So I can't imagine how these public defenders are actually managing day to day, yet alone striving to help others.
You know, as Dr. Nowalnick is talking, Ruth, you're nodding your head. You're recognizing a lot of those symptoms, I gather.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And describe to me yesterday, describe to me last week, people saying, I feel isolated, or I go home and I yell at my kids and I'm not sure why. I feel like when I talk to people about my job, because of the nature of the job we have, you know, you can have a success. You say, well, I had this murder case and it came back voluntary and that was the right outcome. That would have been the proper charge.
Voluntary manslaughter,
right.
You're saying, as opposed to first-degree murder or something.
Something along those lines.
Yeah.
And most of the public is like, ugh. And they don't talk to you about it. So I have my attorneys talk about how when you're isolated because there's so much work and you can't, it's hard to get involved in other things. Two, you're isolated because most of the public feels a little icky about what we do. They're uncomfortable with, you're representing these people who everyone has told us are the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, from our side, we see a very different perspective, but how that impacts you in the rest of your life is very different.
So how do you keep morale up when everyone knows that the work your office does isn't valued as much as the work of, you know, other private attorneys, perhaps, and the caseloads are so enormous, Ruth? How do you begin to manage that as the head of that office?
Well, we certainly, my attorneys, a lot of this do this on their own, as far as everyone's very supportive of each other. And if you know someone, if you have a client who gets a big sentence, especially if it's somewhat unexpected, there's a lot of rallying around people. And there's a lot of celebrating within the office the victories we have. And how we gauge a victory may be different than how
right.
a different office gauges a victory. But we really see our clients as valuable members of the community. And, you know, we want to do what it takes to get them back to the community and back to their families and living their lives. So there's a lot of discussion and support. And we have to support each other because there isn't other support out there in general.
Michael Barrett, again, you head this system in Missouri. The challenge here, I assume, in putting it in layman's terms, is that your lawyers can never do enough. And that just strikes me as such a helpless feeling.
Yeah, you know, it's a challenge because, you know, we keep all the data. So I can tell you, you know, to the doctor's point, that they get annual leave every year, vacation time, and they don't take it. So when they leave the system after being so burned out, I look back and see that they haven't taken a vacation day in years.
Can't you require that, Michael?
Well, you know, that's
easy
my
for
instinct,
me to say.
Instinct,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. My instinct is look, for the long-term benefit of the employee, you need to take some vacation time. But if, you know, if we were mowing lawns for a living, that's easier than if we were taking care of people who are incarcerated and need to get out, who are only in on a nonviolent offense and are losing their jobs and their housing each day they sit in jail. And so those are the pressures that our lawyers take home with them every day.
Dr. Nowalnick, again, what do you think? I mean, what would you, you know, would you require these attorneys to take their annual vacations?
I mean, it's one of those conundrums that you see where people really value the work that they do.
Yes.
And they recognize that in their absence, there's nobody to come and fill in backup. It's not like you have PRN public defenders that you can just call in to quarterback while you're on the sideline. But it's about effectively recognizing that you're not going to be as good. You're not as effective if you're not well.
Yeah.
And that sounds like a luxury that's just not available.
And
Ruth,
you know that all too well, right? He's not telling you anything you don't realize.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I mean, and you can generally see when someone is struggling. You can see how they're interacting with clients. You can see their approach to work. You can see it and how they physically carry themselves.
Yeah.
You can intervene as much as you can, but generally the response you'll get is, well, I have this person and I have these things to do and I have three things set tomorrow and another thing next week and I can't be gone.
How many attorneys do you have in the Kansas City office?
35, including myself.
35, yeah. Okay. We're talking with the Missouri Public Defender's Office and the mental health implications of their heavy, heavy workloads. Michael Barrett, again, Missouri's Public Defender Director. Why is this system so chronically underfunded? I mean, what's the thinking behind that? The state simply has higher priorities, Michael, or what do you pick up from lawmakers?
Well, you know, the starting place is that we're all familiar with the phrase criminal justice system, right? It's a system. It's various parts that work together. But the problem is when it's funded, it's not funded as a system. You know, the judges are funded in a vacuum and the prosecutors and the police are funded in a vacuum. And then, you know, we get what's left over. The problem is when you have that perspective in funding, you create a situation where the system can only move as fast as its slowest part, and that's us. And when you see that the state prison budget in just over a 10-year period from 2006 to 2016 increased $150 million, and we never got incremental increases over that same period, and that put us in such a hole that it's going to take a significant investment in resources for us to be able to catch up at this point.
Yeah. Ruth Petch, again, you head Kansas City's Public Defender's Office. Missouri, though, is no anomaly, right? I mean, lots of states underfund their public defender systems.
Yes, that's true. I do think we're in a pinch.
I'm not justifying anything here. I'm just trying to get some context. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think in Missouri, we also have, we're unable to turn away cases. We're unable to say, you know, here in New Orleans that they stopped taking cases. And we're in a position where at the current state of things, we're unable to turn away cases.
So why can New Orleans do it, but you can't?
Well, it's a state by state decision.
Is it a state law or a state? Someone makes that. Who makes that call?
Well, at this point, the courts are making that call.
Okay.
And as you know, there's litigation surrounding it that I can't go into.
Okay.
But we are, you know, every other lawyer who's not a public defender in the city can turn away cases.
Right. But you guys simply cannot. Yeah. Michael, you've taken some pretty strong steps over the years to draw attention to this situation. If I recall correctly, you actually ordered Jay Nixon, when he was the sitting governor of the state of Missouri, to step in and represent clients. How did that shake out?
Well, look, it's my obligation to fulfill the state's constitutional obligation to make sure that poor people who are charged with a criminal offense and face loss of liberty have a competent attorney. When we don't have the resources to do that job, my function is to is to sound the alarm bells. And if no one's paying attention, I regrettably have to get a little louder, because this is a constitutional requirement. We are not roads. We are not the Parks Department. This is what people are entitled to as American citizens. And so it's our obligation, you know, to make sure that people know we need more resources.
And part of the issue here is what? Is it hard to build public support for the work you do, Michael?
I don't think so at all. I think just interacting with members of the public all the time, I think that they understand that that we have an adversarial system of justice in the United States, and that the only way we arrive at the right answer is if the prosecution and the defense are equally resourced, and that the evidence is tested and the credibility of witnesses is tested, and that's how we get an honest outcome. That's what justice looks like in America. And when there's inequality, then we really run the risk of over-incarcerating and getting the wrong answer. And you've seen that in Missouri. We have gotten to about ninth highest in incarceration rates in America, number one or two, depending on the year, for incarcerating women. This is not demonstrative of a free state or a state that reflects the values of the Sixth Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, or the Eighth Amendment.
What's the issue with incarcerating so many women? What are you referring to there?
Well, we've been in the last 2 years, had a higher incarceration rate for women than any other state in the United States.
Hmm. Before I get away from it, did Governor Nixon actually step in and represent a few clients?
No, he didn't take the case, and the judge let him out of it. But, you know, that's not the point. The point is that to draw attention to a problem that's been allowed to linger for too many years. And we didn't get those incremental increases when our prison population was ballooning. And as a result, we are where we are.
You know, Ruth, again, you head the Kansas City Public Defender's Office. What's the average caseload of your staff attorneys? Do you have a number handy?
At the current time, I would say it's around 100 to 120 cases.
100 to 120 cases.
Currently.
That's just jaw-dropping. Is that number, is it continuing to rise? Is it steady? Is it dropping?
It's significantly rising at this time.
Yeah. You know, Judge John Torrance in Jackson County, Ruth, who's a former public defender himself, has questioned whether the office's problems weren't self-inflicted and brought on by what he called inefficient policies. What about that?
Well, I think as an office, we think very hard about how we use our resources, and we think very hard about what our obligations are to the clients. I certainly don't put a policy in place unless I really it achieves those ends and, mm-hmm. and make sure that I'm following the rules of professional conduct.
I'm wondering why your attorneys don't wind up seeking more help, even when maybe they should. Is it a shame thing, a stigma thing, just a commitment to the job thing? What is it?
I don't think they have time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had other obviously, I have a number of lawyers who are currently in therapy, have been in therapy, have left the job. But I also have a number of lawyers who will talk about their anxiety, the issues that I've talked about, waking up at night or family issues. And what they say is, I don't have time. Like, when would I schedule an hour appointment to see a therapist? When would I schedule all of these things that it would take to be looked at? And
what's the answer to that, as far as you're concerned? I want to get Dr. Nawalnick to weigh in on that, too.
Well, I certainly think it's a priority. I certainly want, you know, as I look at it, I think, you know, in the airplane when they say, put your oxygen mask on before you put on your child's. I mean, people really want to help the clients, and there's they think, oh, if I spend all this time, I'll be helping them more.
Right.
And I definitely encourage my attorneys to take their leave. I encourage them to seek medical attention when they need to, and mental health attention. But it's very hard to break out when you're kind of on the hamster wheel of work. It just is very hard to break out.
Dr. Nawalnick, what do you say to people who say, I don't have time to step away to take care of myself?
Well, I think this comes back to that psychological issue versus medical issue. If somebody had a broken leg, they're not going to suffer through the court day with a compound fracture. But yet rarely does anyone ever die from a compound fracture, but mental health issues that are unchecked over time, people eventually give up. They feel a sense of hopelessness, helplessness, and they disengage from their support systems. They're diving into a work situation where they go home, and even on the news, they're being cast aspersion upon from what they're trying to do to help. And that's a recipe for a suicidal end.
Yeah.
And so we really want people to be reaching out. And as inconvenient, quote unquote, as it might be, it's essential. And you know, you can see people in the evening. You can see people in the weekends. There are certainly mental health professionals available 24/7. And I'd like to say that if anybody is ever harboring suicidal ideation, call 911 immediately. Don't sit with that. Don't wait.
Then you consider, doctor, the nature of these cases, you know, murder cases, sexual assault cases. These are heavy, dark, depressing kinds of matters that these attorneys deal with.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a potential here for a systemic long-term solution in terms of maybe embedding a mental health professional in the public defender office. So
they're, that's interesting.
So they're readily available. They can just pop in at any time, you know, just to debrief, just to vent with no judgment whatsoever and all the support in the world.
We'll have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Dr. Greg Nowalnick again. He's with the University of Kansas's Health Systems Strawberry Hill campus. And Michael and Ruth, wish you all the best. We'll be rooting for you. Ruth Pesch heads the Kansas City Public Defender's Office. Michael Barrett is the state of Missouri's Public Defender Director. Again, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for having us.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the need to find more computer developers and programmers in Kansas City and a new program designed to help with just that. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Sign up for my weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, at kcur.org/Kraske. It's got fresh insights from me and highlights from the show in your inbox each Monday. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. Tomorrow is Friday, and we're going to sit down again with local young adult author L.L. McKinney. We'll talk about the latest book in her Wonderland series and how she navigated the world of publishing as a young Black woman. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when one St. Louis businessman started his company, he quickly found out there weren't enough computer developers and programmers to fill all the positions he needed. Turns out that cities all over the country were struggling to fill tech jobs. That need gave birth to the launch of a nonprofit called Launch Code that offers free training and even paid apprenticeships. The aim was to fill the big void in qualified workers. Launch Code has an office in Kansas City, and it's making a difference. Now a conversation about Launch Code and the workers it's helped. With us, John Woolbridge is Launch Code's Candidate Engagement Manager for Kansas City. John, good morning. Nice to have you.
Morning. Thanks for having us.
John, how does this work, and what's the program's relationship with Rockhurst University?
So as far as our relationship with Rockhurst University, they're more or less a like an in-kind donor. They lend the space out to us.
Sure.
So aside from that, like you were saying, it's a program that our main goal is to launch tech careers. We've launched over 2,000 tech careers across the nation and trained over 6,000 different individuals in software development.
You know, Launch Code is a nonprofit. How does it cover its expenses?
So it's a nonprofit. We're a 501 nonprofit organization, but our funding is it's very unique. While we do rely on public and private grants, we do get a lot of revenue from our donors, companies like the Kauffman Foundation, the U.S. Bank, John and Effie Spees Memorial, and of course, having in-kind donors like Rockhurst.
What's the application process like for someone who wants to get engaged with it?
So anybody can apply. You don't have to have any prerequisites. You could have no experience to software development, no exposure
to
coding.
Right?
Yep. And it's, I would say it probably takes maybe a half an hour to apply.
Okay. Do you get more applications than you can accept?
Yes, we do. We're expecting somewhere around 600 applications for this upcoming cohort, and we can only take 150 people, which is all the class will fit.
How do you winnow that list down?
We take the application in as a whole. We review it. There's a problem-solving assessment, and then there's also essay questions that the applicants fill out.
Any hope of teaching the class more often? Because as you said, you just do it once a year, I think.
Right now in Kansas City, it's only once a year. I believe that that's something that we would like to do in the future, is have multiple classes per year.
And when does the next class begin?
It starts on October 7th.
Okay. Can people still apply?
Yes. The deadline is September 26th, so time is running short.
And where can they go to make that application?
It is launchcode.org/LC101 is the application link.
And we'll put that up on our website later today. What kind of dent has LaunchCode put into the national shortage of developers and programmers, John?
So as far as nationwide, code.org reports that there's over 500,000 open computing jobs nationwide. Hmm. And LaunchCode itself has launched over 2,000 careers to kind of help narrow that gap, and trained over 6,000 different individuals.
Okay, I want to bring in a couple of graduates of this program. Sally Kramer is an assistant administrator at Commerce Bank. Sally, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi.
Also with us is Bonnie Y. She's a technology apprentice at VMLY&R. Bonnie, good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So what drew the two of you to LaunchCode, Sally? How'd you get going there?
Well, I kind of come from a non-traditional background. I have an undergraduate degree in fine arts weaving and a graduate degree in education, and I've been working at the Nelson Atkins Art Museum for 12 years. And I kind of wanted to make some progress in my career and sort of try some new things. And I was looking around at which direction to go, and this program got recommended to me by a friend whose wife had done it in the previous cohort. So,
well, going from the Nelson Atkins to computer programming, that's a big jump across the pond. What are you thinking?
Good challenges, fun puzzles to solve.
And that's what it is, basically, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Bonnie, how about you? What got you thinking about LaunchCode?
Well, I've always had an interest in coding. I started teaching myself how to make websites when I was a kid. And then my sister found out about LaunchCode, I probably through Facebook, and she told me that I should apply for that. And once I found out, I was like, yeah.
Yeah. How has it changed your life so far?
Well, going from a server to having a full-time job without a degree, a lot.
Mm-hmm. And how so? I mean, how is this making things better for you?
Well, it gives me more of a purpose in life. I feel like I've finally found my thing. So that's really been a very nice, eye-opening kind of experience.
Yeah, how about you, Sally? How's it changed things for you?
There is a lot more opportunity going forward. I feel like I've got a legitimate path forward and sort of long-term goals that I can reach in a way that my prior career didn't provide as much.
Yeah. What was the hardest part of the application process that John was talking about? What did you find tough about it?
Honestly, I didn't find it particularly challenging. Like, the application is basically, you know, tell us about yourself, and then a problem-solving test. It's not asking if you already know how to program. It's asking, like, if you look at this problem, can you think through it?
Mm-hmm. Did you find it tough, Bonnie?
The toughest part for me was the essay questions, because writing about yourself is always the hardest.
Yeah.
But other than that, no. I just looked at the assessment as it's just trying to see where I'm at and if I would be a good fit.
Did either of you have any coding experience before you did this?
I had a little. I did HTML and CSS and a little bit of JavaScript, mostly just copy and pasting and seeing if it would work and not really knowing how.
Yeah, Sally,
it would work.
Did you?
No, the closest I had to that was weaving, which is tangentially approachable to this, but is not at all the same.
So your degree was literally in weaving?
Yes.
I mean, I bet you've heard the jokes lots of times about that. I thought people thought that was like a stereotype or a Saturday Night Live skit or something.
It's a real thing that you can manage it in textiles. So
yeah, how is that related to coding?
So the original, like, looms and computers developed together. So punch card coding comes from Jacquard looms. And I've essentially done punch card coding because I've programmed Jacquard looms.
I'm not sure a lot of people would have made that connection, but you just did. Yeah, that's what it is. How challenging was the class?
It was definitely had its challenging moments. There were times
you meet
where
a couple times a week kind of thing.
Yeah, it's 2 times a week. It's kind of like a mostly like a college credit. So you meet 2 times a week, 3 hours per class. And the most challenging part really was just pushing through your own doubts about whether or not you could do it. And honestly, it's interesting to think back about what I had problems with. And that was really mostly just being like getting out of your own head and making sure that you just keep pressing forward, because you're going to have that click moment when everything just makes sense.
You know, going back to school for a lot of people can be pretty intimidating.
Yep.
Was it for you?
Yes, definitely. The first day I had a lot of nerves. I haven't been in a classroom setting in many years, but once you get in, it's, you know, it's very comfortable. Everyone's very helpful, and it's really great the way it's structured with the lecture. And then you break out into a TA group so you can get to know some of your peers a little bit better. And then you have your TA who is like a first pass before you ask the lecturer a question. So you have someone who's a little bit more comfortable to ask questions to.
What was particularly challenging for you? I mean, what was it that made you nervous and things that maybe tied you up a little bit?
It was more just making sure that I did all of the prep work, and when I didn't get something, reaching out for a question or just continuing on.
How about you, Sally? What was particularly tough about the class?
So because I come from no coding background, essentially, besides looms and punching holes in paper, a lot of it was just sort of, there's always things that sort of you assume people know, and it's hard not to assume that. And I think that the thing that really helped me through that was it was just an amazing community environment. I introduced myself to somebody on my way into the lecture hall on the first day, and we ended up sitting together through the whole thing, and we still get together once a week, and we're sort of career mentors for each other and each other out with projects.
Well, you both graduated and then went into what's called the Liftoff Program. John, you're very involved with that part of it. What goes on in the Liftoff Program?
So Liftoff's an 8-week optional course after LC101, after you graduate from LC101, and the idea and the objective of Liftoff is to make sure that every student or candidate is job ready. So working with things like a personal project to display to companies, or whether that be a LinkedIn profile, a resume, any things of that nature.
Sally, what was most helpful part of the Liftoff Program for you?
A lot of the hard part of breaking in, I think, is networking and knowing people. And that was a thing that really helped me with that was I set up some interviews on my own. I set up a lot of interviews through them. And actually, I ended up getting an internship that was straight up from a connection through Liftoff.
Wow. John Woolbright, once the Liftoff is done, is that when LaunchCode starts notifying graduates of these paid apprenticeships? And where do those come from? And how does the LaunchCode connect with those opportunities?
So, yes, if you complete the Liftoff program, you're automatically accepted into our apprenticeship program. And that's when we start having you work with our company partners to get you into an apprenticeship with one of the companies here in Kansas City.
Yeah. I was going to say, if there's a company in the Kansas City area right now hearing this with a need for someone who can code, how can they get that position to LaunchCode? How does that happen?
Just reach out to us. Basically, we do job readiness type stuff for them. If they're looking for, people with the skill set, we can definitely supply them with the assets.
Bonnie, what was the interviewing process for your apprenticeship like?
I don't know how other places do the interviews, but at VMLY&R, there was 2 sets of interviews, and each one had 2 people in each one, and they kind of just asked me different questions. The first one was, to me, felt more like a personality type, behavioral question type, and the second one was definitely a lot more technically focused, but it was very interesting and definitely not something I've ever experienced before.
Just really quickly, where do you see yourself in 10 years in this business? Where are you going?
I'm hoping to be converted at where I work. And then
what does that mean, converted where you work?
Well, right now I'm a contractor, so
I see. You want to become a full-time employee?
I want to become a full-time employee at VML Y&R, and then hopefully after that, like, be a dev lead, help foster new people and continue to learn everything that there is to learn. Oh, well, you know, you can't learn everything there is,
yeah,
but, you know, as much as possible.
Well, it's so interesting to hear all this. That's the voice of Bonnie Y. She's a technology apprentice at VML Y&R. Sally Kramer's here. She's at Commerce Bank. John Woolbright is LaunchCode's candidate engagement manager here in Kansas City. Thank you all for a good conversation. Good luck in your careers. Hope it goes well.
Thank you,
John.
Very
thanks
much.
Thank
very
you
much.
Very much.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and Spencer Hardwick and your weekend to-do list. Okay, here we go. KCUR contributor Brian McTavish is here. He follows and writes about pop culture. With him is Spencer Hardwick, founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. They join us here in the studio to talk each week with some cool stuff to do on the upcoming weekend. Gentlemen, how are you?
Doing fantastic.
Nice to have you both here again.
Absolutely fine,
yeah,
and dandy.
Yeah.
Even though fall's this weekend, it seems like summer wants to stay a little bit longer.
Boy, tell me about it. But I think today's the last day in the 90s for a while. At least I hope so.
It's Fingers
been
crossed.
Too much. Spencer, tell us about Truistapalooza.
Absolutely.
So it's a cool deal.
So my wife is from Chicago, and we often talk about what makes a vibrant city. And one thing that we talk about is this notion of collision spaces. Places in the city.
Collision spaces,
yes,
you're saying.
Yes.
Not car accidents.
No, collision spaces. Yeah. Places in the city where people naturally have to integrate and interact with each other.
Right.
Along race, class, gender lines, you know, any kind of lines of difference. And so when I think of Truist and what it's historically meant to our community, it's been a dividing line.
Right.
Truistapalooza is trying to change that narrative. Over 100 vendors, local businesses, nonprofits, vintage vendors, all trying to make sure that, you know, Truist maintains a vibrant presence in the city. And so there's things like Escape of Skateboarding, UMKC Rules Basketball, Mind Drive, drone racing, tons of different things, food trucks, obviously, to get people out and about on Truist.
Yeah. This happens on Saturday from when to when?
12 to 7 p.m., 30th and Truist. They even have a bounce house. Brian, when's the last time you were in a bounce house?
It's funny you should ask that.
I bounce houses.
I was 12 and I was injured.
Yep, that sounds about right.
You collided with some other kid, probably.
Oh, it was their fault. But yeah, I recall being very afraid for a few minutes, and then I realized I was going to make it.
There you go.
Not a break, just a sprain.
That's a very cool thing. This is down by Operation Breakthrough, then,
absolutely,
right? Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I was just down there this week with a class. Okay, Truistapalooza this Saturday from noon to 12:30 in Truist. I like that song. Why are we listening to it?
I like it, too. Well, that's Greta Van Fleet.
Nice tune.
You know, rock music. Rock music, you are so cool. You stay young and strong while the rest of us grow old and frail. How do you do it, rock music? How do you do it? Well,
yeah.
One way, bands like Greta Van Fleet.
Yes.
They play 8 o'clock. Is it Saturday night at Starlight Theater? Is that what we have here?
Yeah.
Well, you lure the young and the strong into the ways of rock. That's how rock lives and thrives and survives and gets better. Today's Exhibit A.
You sound like a preacher.
I am a preacher for rock.
Rock and roll
is here to stay. It will never die. I don't care what people say. Rock and roll is here to stay.
Right.
Exhibit A today, Michigan-born rock outfit Greta Van Fleet. You can call them a 1970s-style retro band. You wouldn't be wrong, but this 7-year-old group
led by brothers Josh Kiska on vocals and guitarist Jake Kiska on guitar, while certainly copying the postures and riffs of classic rockers like Led Zeppelin. You hear it, I hear it. But they're also about the here and the now. Can you feel it?
Yes.
I know you can.
Speak it.
Play it. They're in support of their 2018 album, Anthem of the Peaceful Army. You can enlist when this band performs again Saturday night at Starlight Theater. Very quickly, also, fans of classic rock can get their fix through tribute bands this weekend. There's Rock Gods, a tribute show featuring 1980s hard rock star celebrations, 8 o'clock Friday. But even better, Monsters of Rock with a Cars cover band. Rick Ocasek, You're Gone But Not Forgotten, Saturday night at Crossroads KC.
What do we have here, Spencer?
Now, does that music ring a bell for either of you two?
Yes, it does.
So the Harry Potter generation is all grown up. And what do we decide to do with all that wizardry and inspiration from J.K. Rowling?
Yes.
Have a bar crawl, of course. So this Saturday, 4 p.m. at Power and Light District, we will have a Harry Potter bar crawl called Expecto Bar Crawl. Yeah. Expecto is an incantation. Brian was like, what the heck is Expecto?
Yeah, it's not Expecto.
Is that from the book?
Exactly. It's one of the most popular spells in the book. Costumes are encouraged, but not required. But what's a Harry Potter event without people showing up and all of their wizard stuff? So make sure that you pack your wand, even though it says it's encouraged, not required. And if it's any indication as to how hot this event's going to be, over 1,000 people are interested on Facebook.
No, did you read the books?
Absolutely. I read them both twice. I don't think you're truly a part of my generation unless you didn't read the Harry Potter series at least twice.
Isn't
all the way
that the truth?
Nerd alert.
Okay. And this is going to be when again?
4 p.m. Power and Light District's participating venues are McFadden's Pizza Bar, Hotel Karaoke, Guys Dive and Taco Joint, Liney Dodge and Barn Garden.
Okay, that sounds good. Speaking of bar hopping.
Yeah, let's keep the bar crawling and the other kind of crawling going. How about the end of the world pub crawl?
Wow. Is it that?
That escalated quickly.
It did. Okay, so that's a good one. Okay, so bar hoppers will do their best to flee members of the Walking Dead between visiting various watering holes and perhaps winning survival prizes if they're lucky. This all happens from 1 to 5 Saturday at several bars at Martini Corner. Go east on 31st Street off of Main, and you'll hit them.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is to crawl between these bars and prevent a zombie from yanking your flag. Your flag is your life. It's like flag football without the football.
Mm.
If you're not smart and fast and quick, you'll be zombie food. Once again, costumes are also encouraged, Spencer, for this event. Prizes will be awarded to the person in the best costume. If I was going to do this as a patron, I'd go as a zombie.
Yeah.
Confuse everyone.
Yep. And then head on down to Power and Light.
Oh, that's exactly right. And speaking of zombies, perhaps heading on down, there is a Grub Crawl 2019, later in the day, Saturday, starting at 6 o'clock at City Market. Totally non-zombie tasting tour of 18 restaurants, but frankly, I would keep an eye out for a zombie or two could make it down there. Be careful.
Why do I want to express myself, Spencer?
Steve, we're all very familiar with the Plaza Art Fair, which is happening this weekend,
yes,
correct?
Yes, it's a big one.
But have you heard of the Unplaza Art Fair
that will not be
happening adjacent? So you'll have over 100 local artists featuring ceramics, jewelry, glass art, wood carving, mixed media, fiber art, photography, and paintings. Mm. I did a little Googling on what the Unplaza Art Fair is, and the themes that kept emerging were affordable art, diversity, and equity. This will take place at Southmoreland Park, just west of the Nelson.
So right there.
Museum. Absolutely.
At your prime option. Okay.
Yep.
And finally today. And what animals we have represented here. This is our little nature call here.
Yes, nature, Mother Nature. We love our Mother Nature, the birds, the bees. All of that. You'll get that and a whole lot more, as we'll soon learn, at Terra Luna at the Arboretum. It's a dreamlike, immersive, super multimedia enhanced garden walk. Mm. I prefer strolling to walking. Walking sounds too fast.
And Quixotic's going to be
there. Yes, the aerial.
That's a reason to go.
Yes, yes, yes. The aerial acrobatics of none other than Kansas City's own Quixotic Performance Art Group show up.
Is that them making all these animal sounds?
Well, that's exactly what's happening, Steve.
It's
that's
you,
right.
You and your family?
And those are the sounds that we will make in response to what we will see. And what will we see starting at 7:30 p.m. tonight? And again, 7:30 Friday and Saturday nights at the Overland Park Arboretum and Botanical Gardens. We'll get light, we'll get sound, we'll get live music, and we will get what organizers are calling a chance to go through a, quote, portal between everyday reality and elemental fantasy. Can I get an ooh?
Ooh.
Ooh.
Ah,
I'll
throw it out for you.
And embedded performers stationed along the mysteriously stirring garden journey. I give it another
goodness.
Ooh.
My goodness. Yeah. That sounds pretty incredible.
Anyway.
That's Spencer Hardwick, Brian McTavish, and your weekend to-do list. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thank
nice
you, guys.
Job.
Great.
KCPT's Nick Haines is normally in the hosting seat. Yesterday on the show, I turned the tables on him. Hear why he left the shores of Wales for reporting out here in the Midwest. That's at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Friday on the show, her novels are an urban twist on classic fantasies like Alice in Wonderland. I'll ask one Kansas City young adult author about the inspiration for her latest book and something called Black Girl Magic. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.